It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It's Wednesday, May 1st, 2024. Welcome to a new month here on the Guy Benson Show. I'm your host, Guy Benson, political editor at townhall.com and a Fox News contributor. Very happy to have you here every weekday for this program between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Then around the clock for free on demand, we have a podcast. Always no charge to you. Always readily available as soon as the show is over, including bonus Benson on the weekends, I will add. GuyBensonShow.com is our online home and resource for all sorts of content, including that podcast. If you're a podcast fan or miss any of the show as it airs, your other options are FoxNewsPodcast.com or just wherever you download your favorite podcasts. We are there. All right, our lineup today is going to be a good one. Joining us in studio later this hour is former Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California. He's been out of that position now for months. His successor may be now in jeopardy based on some new developments today. What does Kevin McCarthy think of everything that's been going on since he left? We will ask him. In the next hour, a different McCarthy, Andy McCarthy, our colleague and friend here, will join us once again to review what's happening in the Trump legal trial, I would say debacle, fiasco, at least so far, in my opinion. What happened in New York, maybe some analysis at the Supreme Court as well. Andy's been writing voraciously about all of this and actually has advanced a case that the prosecution against Trump in New York by Alvin Bragg is unto itself unconstitutional under state law. Why does he say that? We will ask him coming up later in the program. And then in a very special series of segments that I'm looking forward to in our final hour, just after 5 p.m. Eastern time, recently we were up in New York and we had a Jewish Israeli student at Columbia who joined us from our New York headquarters to talk about what he has experienced, including being called a Nazi as the grandson of a Holocaust survivor. We got his story in his own words. He just came from campus, which is not too far from Fox News up there. Well, here in D.C. today, I will have 3 students in studio with me, all of whom are currently enrolled at my alma mater, my beloved alma mater, Northwestern. 2 undergraduates and a graduate student will be here. The reason they're in D.C. is because they are meeting with members of this House Education Committee that has been overseeing the explosion of anti-Semitism across our campuses in the form of pro-Hamas hate rallies and now these encampments that have been spreading, especially across so-called elite campuses, unfortunately including theirs, ours, at NU. So they took some time off from meeting with lawmakers on the Hill to come over here, and we sat down with them earlier and talked through what they have been experiencing, not even just for the last week or two with the encampment that may or may not be gone fully at this point at Northwestern, with some developments there that we'll perhaps get to, but also since October 7th, with a climate of hatred and ugliness playing out almost every day, but certainly spiking at certain heated moments in a way that has been extremely distressing, concerning for many people, but especially Jewish students who feel, in many cases, physically unsafe on campus, targeted, unwelcome in a lot of ways, and just abandoned, unsupported by the so-called or alleged adults in charge who are supposed to be running a university and not, to call on, I think, the colorful statement from the University of Florida that's handled this very well, not a daycare center for a collection of student and outside bigots, misfits, Islamists, communists, malcontents, you name it. So the left likes to talk about lived experience and about hate speech being violence and all that kind of thing. It's fascinating the types of lived experience that they actually discount or don't care about or actively despise, actually, when it doesn't go along with their preferred narrative or their ideological project or their temper tantrum of the day. And how actual violence is often minimized or excused, where they conflate, in other cases, speech that they don't like, including, in many cases, anodyne speech, with violence that they cannot be subjected to. There just aren't any consistent rules, particularly with the hard left. We see this over and over again, and we saw it play out in vivid color last night. This is where I want to begin. Last night in New York City and in Los Angeles, the police, let's start at Columbia, NYPD finally went back in to that campus. They cleared the pro-terrorism encampment. That's what it is. Their own iconography, chants, and placards demonstrate that that was a pro-terrorism encampment run by really crazy radical extreme people, some of whom have expressed murderous desire out loud. There's been harassment and bullying and assault of Jewish students, of course, Zionists, the bad Jews is what they call them, Zionists. Well, that is at least for the time being gone. Classes are now going to be remote. It's unclear whether they're going to get their act together for exams. Those will likely be remote. They're going to try to hold a graduation, unlike at USC, where they've canceled the main graduation because of a similar mess on the other side of the country. But the police not only had to clear the encampment, they had to clear a whole building. We talked about this yesterday. The students, defying the university's final line in the sand, final deadline, a bunch of them assaulted people, smashed windows, and took over and occupied a building on campus, Hamilton Hall, unfurling signage, glorifying terrorism in the Intifada, repeating eliminationist slogans. It's all on camera. So the cops, because they barricaded themselves in there, the students did, just trashed the place. These absolute brats trashed the place to let other people clean up the mess, including custodians who say that they were briefly held captive by these people, weren't allowed to leave at first from that building that they swarmed into. The cops had to go in a second floor window because of the barricade with all of the like equipment and furniture that they'd piled up at the entrances. So they entered the second floor and cleared it out. And boy, did a lot of people, the usual suspects, get really mad about that. Not just the students, but their cheerleading squad in the squad, for example, members of Congress, certain members of the media, trying to pretend that this was just an unjustified, over-the-top police crackdown on otherwise peaceful demonstrators who were just against war and genocide. What a crock. These are not anti-war rallies. These are pro-war rallies. They're rooting for the other side of the war. They're rooting for Hamas to win. There's a reason why they won't condemn Hamas. It's because they're cheering their slogans. They're rooting for Hamas. This is pro-violence, pro-terrorism, pro-war. That's the mentality that we're talking about among a lot of not just the zealots off campus, but on campus as well. And they're not just peaceable. They engage in criminal acts and violence, property destruction, and violence against people as well. Breaking not just campus rules, but laws. And seeing them cleared out and the police doing as professional a job as they can, dragging them out, arresting them en masse. We'll see if there's any consequences for these people. If they really face serious charges, if there's any prosecutions, if they're suspended or expelled. I mean, absolutely, that needs to happen. But would I bet on it? Probably not. Probably not, given, I don't know, everything that we've seen now for weeks. And the feckless, gutless weakness, cowardice of the people running a lot of these schools. So at least at long last at Columbia, some order has been restored as of last night. And the number of people treating it like it was some crime against humanity where these kids are victims, I mean, it just turns my stomach. My contempt for these students is high, but my contempt for their defenders, their justifiers, their enablers, that's a lot deeper. The adults who run the school, at least nominally on paper, and members of Congress or members of the journalism community who go out of their way to whitewash and gaslight and rationalize and selectively cover what has been a hate-filled mob for weeks on that campus. They escalated. Then the police come in to actually enforce rules and laws, and they're accused by some of being the escalating factor. And a lot of those people hate the police as well because they're the dregs of society. Some of the worst people among us are the loudest shouters on behalf of Hamas, unsurprisingly, because Hamas are rapists, murderers, terrorists. If you're defending them or sympathizing with them, you're probably an awful person. Then there's UCLA. So let's hop across the country, Southern California. We'd been telling you about growing danger on that campus. We played some of the audio from videos where you have masked mobs setting up basically terrorism checkpoints all around campus. And if you're a Zionist and you're not wearing a specific type of wristband they created, I saw someone joke they should be armbands. Not a subtle reference there. You can't pass. You don't have free movement on campus. You can't go through the checkpoint unless you are in agreement with them that the Jewish state should be exterminated. Then you can walk through. If not, they've got their Palestinian head garb and scarves and all of that, and you cannot walk by, especially if you're a Zionist and especially if you're a Jewish Zionist, which is 90% of Jews in America. There was a journalist who was detained for a while there. There was a Native American woman who was assaulted and had her sign ripped up by these absolute thugs. A kid not allowed in the library, another kid just trying to get to class. Nope, you can't. As they blocked his way, we talked about all of this. And then yesterday, reportedly, there was a Jewish girl who was knocked unconscious and sent to the hospital. That was reported in local media. And this is now days and days of lawless chaos, increasing violence, bullying. I mean, I saw Mark Penn, I believe it was, made the point on the news channel recently. Can you imagine if the Klan, like students who had allied with the Ku Klux Klan, wearing their white masks and robes, had set up checkpoints on some campus and weren't letting black students through unless they agreed with the Klan? How would that go over? I mean, it's just like, it's such an insane counterexample because it would never be tolerated by anyone, ever, in this country, and it shouldn't be. But this is very much analogous. The Klan was and is, to the extent that it still exists, filled with disgusting bigots, and that's the overall vibe, the overall, really, credo of these pro-Hamas hate rallies as well. But they're getting away with it, and it got more and more dangerous, more and more violent. Then there was this report about a Jewish girl being sent to the hospital, and guess what? With the mob controlling campus, administration officials doing nothing, security people just standing there doing nothing, a group of counter-protesters, really a counter-mob, got together, more than 100 of them, and they showed up on campus and physically fought the jihadists and communists. It was actual crazy violence on campus between these two sides. Throwing projectiles, throwing punches. it's amazing someone didn't get even more seriously hurt. But it was just an all-out physical fight in the middle of the night. Hundreds of people involved. And even though I sympathize with some of the frustration of the counter mob, I cannot condone what they did. Violence is not acceptable. And also, it was made almost inevitable by the people in charge, quote unquote, at UCLA, allowing it to go this far. You let a mob control campus, you're going to get a counter mob, and there's going to be violence. The lawsuits against UCLA might be the most damaging and spectacular in the country, at least so far on this front. What a disgraceful failure at UCLA. And finally, the riot police had to come in. Public school. Take them to the cleaners with lawsuits. It might be the only way. We told you about UNC, Chapel Hill, yesterday. Things got ugly there, but there was actually a really great thing that happened as well. We'll tell you about that as soon as we come back. Just getting started on this Wednesday, it's the Guy Benson Show.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective.
The Guy Benson Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
I'm Guy Benson. Yesterday at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the Hamas mob did what it did. They tore down the American flag and put up the Palestinian flag. School's chancellor came out and personally hoisted the American flag back up. And then the Hamas supporters were going to go back to take it down again until something happened. A lot of fraternity members watched this and had enough. And they decided to go and physically protect the American flag from the braying mob. And they were cursed at and abused, pelted with objects and liquids. But they stood there, and there's video of it and footage and photographs as well. One of the frat brothers, Guillermo Estrada, probably call him a white supremacist, but I doubt it. Guillermo Estrada posted a Twitter thread about this, which has now been viewed millions of times. And he said, I don't know much about the conflict, but I didn't like seeing my country's flag treated that way on my campus. He said there was profanity, middle fingers, thrown bottles, rocks, and water. He said the Greek community, in support of America, sang the U.S. national anthem and then intervened to prevent the removal and destruction of the American flag. He said my brothers and others ran over to hold it up, meaning the flag, and for it not to touch the ground. People threw water bottles at us, rocks, sticks, calling us profane names. We stood for an hour defending the flag. So many fight to protect. My parents started a new life in the United States, a country that has helped them flourish and raise two kids. I grew up in a military community. I will not stand for the disrespect of these quote-unquote protesters. God bless this young man and the other members of the Greek community who stood up and did what was right. UNC frat bros for the win. Bravo, gentlemen.
Out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan. But you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you're subscribed to the podcast. Like, subscribe, and share.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
So glad you're here on The Guy Benson Show, Wednesday edition, Washington, D.C. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free when the show is over. Well, I'm very pleased to welcome back in studio Kevin McCarthy, former Speaker of the House, former California Congressman. Last time you were here in studio with me, you were sitting in that chair right there, and you were not yet Speaker. And now here we are together. You were speaker for a while. We remember how that all went down. We'll talk about maybe
some
of that.
Wait a minute. Then I'm beginning to think you're bad luck.
I think it probably wasn't me. It's just a guess. Just a guess that it wasn't me. Before we get into congressional drama, although there's actually a tie-in.
Okay.
We were just talking about what's happening kind of in your neck of the woods, an hour and a half from your district, UCLA. One of the worst examples, but it's playing out all sorts of places, campuses around the country, anti-Semitic, pro-Hamas mobs and violence, and administrations, especially at UCLA, just being like, well, if you have masked terrorism supporters setting up checkpoints where Jews can't pass, so be it. I mean, I can't believe this is happening.
You wouldn't think this was America, for one, but there's a number of reasons for it. If you study history, the world looks like a lot like the 1930s. I mean, the actions of Putin are very similar to Hitler. You can walk them all through the movement. Hitler went and created an axis of evil, empire in Asia that wanted to expand. Then he went to Italy. You look at what Putin did, bounding with China, North Korea, a movement within Asia, then Iran, who wants to take over. You've got a weakness in the presidency that pushed our allies away. Then you watched what happened recently when the Democrats controlled Congress. Congresswoman Omar equated America and Israel equal to Hamas and the Taliban. And the leadership of the Democrats wouldn't rebuke her. Nancy Pelosi actually goes on TV to clarify that she would not rebuke her because she's an integral part of their conference.
And that was when they were in the majority.
Yes, and kept her on foreign affairs, where she would get classified briefings. When I became speaker, I removed her from foreign affairs. Congresswoman Tlaib tried to have a celebration against the creation of Israel on the 75th anniversary of Israel. I removed the room for her able to have. Then she went to Bernie Sanders and held it in her office. No rebuke from the Democrats. So if you're wondering, why is this now sparking up on our college campuses just a few years later? Well, if it's allowed in the halls of Congress under the Democratic leadership, why wouldn't those on the college campuses? But more importantly, why wouldn't those who want to fund it? Because if you look at the arrest in Columbia last night where they took over and ransacked, how many of those were actually students? So if you're wondering, could Hamas come to America? It's happening right now. I'll guarantee you they're recruiting in those tents. I'll guarantee you the funding of where it's coming from to disruption. And what's it doing? Disrupting the universities, taking American flags down, replacing it with foreign flags, and thinking nothing's wrong with that. Intimidating students based upon their faith. We remember what happened in America when individuals would block education for Americans based upon the color of their skin? Why isn't it the same uproar today? Why isn't the actions of this administration taking the actions of where John Kennedy took back then, where his brother, as the attorney general, sent the troops in to make sure those students would get to class? I mean, how does Biden sit by being the leader of the free world, knowing that he's the president of the United States, understanding history of what's transpiring, and allow this to continue on? You know, if we're concerned about what's happening on these college campuses, just wait to see what's going to happen at the Democrat convention.
That's, I think, a preview. I think we're seeing it now of what's coming down the pike. And we'll have more to say later in the show, actually, about Congresswoman Ilhan Omar.
But UCLA is a University of California college.
Public.
Where's the governor? This also builds with the wokeism of what they wanted to put into these universities for presidents, not focus on education. And now,
well, this is the outgrowth of it, right?
It totally is.
Yeah. And your point about Omar, and I said we're going to refer more to her later in the show, she has these occasional outbursts of anti-Semitism. I think she's absolutely...
Her daughter is a part of Columbia and was a part of this.
Yeah, at Barnard.
And then here comes the squad to defend it.
Oh, and she was hugging the guy who said that he wants all Zionists dead and might want to kill them himself. I mean, that was...
Is that not hate speech?
He was embraced by Ilhan Omar, who years ago, when you guys were still in the minority, Pelosi was speaker, she had one of her occasional anti-Semitic outbursts. Clearly textbook anti-Semitism. And they couldn't even pass a resolution condemning anti-Semitism because the party rushed to defend her. They watered it down and turned it into an all lives matter.
Exactly.
You know, condemnation. You're saying that the seeds of what we're seeing on campus right now have been sown for a while, even on Capitol Hill.
Connect the dots. Congresswoman Omar comes to Congress. Less than 12,000 people have ever had that privilege. She grew up in a foreign land, and America did what America does best. It opens up her arms, right? Brings people in that wants a more perfect union. But she somehow hates this country. Her hate speech went in. Now, who is in the first protest in these colleges is arrested? Her daughter. Who knows where the funding comes from? Who celebrates it and brings her friends, other members of Congress, to defend what they're doing against America?
She just at Columbia called Jewish students who support Israel pro-genocide. I know that Don Bacon from Nebraska is drawing up a censure resolution for her. Should she be censured?
Yes. Look, I removed her from foreign affairs for a reason.
Yeah.
People could have difference of opinion, but the hate speech? To have, think if she was getting classified briefings on what's happening in the Middle East, who would she share them with? You wonder.
Former Speaker Kevin McCarthy with us here in studio. So it was a real bear of a journey to get to the speakership. Covered that here every day for what was a week or whatever it was.
That was good radio, though, wasn't it?
It was.
More people are watching C-SPAN than at any time in C-SPAN yeah, history. No.
The ratings bonanza for C-SPAN, for sure. And then you had the gavel. Then there was a group of people, very small group of people, but the majority was so small. That
there's
had...
just eight, but all the Democrats. But, you know, you missed that time between the speakership and that transpiring. Think about what we did. We had the largest cut in American history, more than $2 trillion. Reformed welfare, NEPA reform, pulled back $20 billion from the IRS that was already funded to do those audits. We passed H.R. 2, the toughest border security bill, Parents' Bill of Rights. We passed energy independence. I mean, every week we were building and building, passing some of the – if you look at the first 6 months, it's one of the most productive times in Congress people have had. But then you have one member of Congress, Matt Gaetz, who has an ethics complaint against him, who came to me to try to get me to influence the Ethics Committee. And for America to understand, the Ethics Committee is always equal number of Republicans and number of Democrats. I don't ever talk to them. They could investigate me. I don't know. And it was a investigation that happened 4 years prior. See, there's an allegation that he slept with a 17-year-old and paid her. Now, is it viable? Well, they have a right to investigate it, but the people around him are in jail for it. And so he wanted me to somehow stop this, which I would not. So then he went and got seven other Republicans and every single Democrat to try to dictate who the speaker can be. And he was able to change that because of the motion to vacate. Now, since that time, what has transpired? Have we been able to secure the border now? No, we missed that opportunity. When Israel was attacked on October 7th, he had just removed me. Was there any action? No, it took 6 months later. What type of message does that send to Iran and the rest of the world when we're looking in the 1930s?
And now your
but
successor.
These eight wanted to deal, worked with all the Democrats.
Now your successor, eventually, Mike Johnson, he's under fire as well from some of the same characters, but it's kind of a different group. Marjorie Taylor Greene was more of an ally of yours. Now she's going after Speaker Johnson here. Apparently, there's going to be, here we go again, motion to vacate potentially next week.
It won't go anywhere.
You don't think it'll succeed?
No. The Democrats said they want to. They'll table it. But, I mean, the things you have to look at now, since that transpired, remember, I was leader for 5 years. During those 5 years, Pelosi was speaker, four of those. We gained 5 seats in California, Republicans did. We gained 5 in New York. We won the majority. In both election cycles, when Republicans lost the presidency, both cycles they lost the Senate, legislature and governors, you know what never lost? Congress. In fact, when Biden won the presidency, do you
the
know?
The House.
But do you realize when Biden won the presidency 4 years ago, was the first time since 1994 no Republican incumbent lost? And if you watch what we were able to do about recruiting, we elected the most women, the most minorities in congressional history for Republicans. We raised more money. Just the super PAC I raised had more money than the DCCC and their super PAC combined. The candidates, more. And now, where are we? Well, we haven't been able to move anything. We've didn't get border. The Democrats got the bill they wanted to pass. You now have Democrats with more money.
Do you think that was a mistake by Speaker Johnson?
Well, what I look at, look, if you're the Speaker of the House, you control, you're the majority. What you should do is negotiate directly with the president. Would I ever have gotten $2 trillion in cuts, welfare reform, NEPA reform, and take the IRS money if I sat down with Hakeem and Schumer? They would never agree to that. The power you have as Speaker is being the majority, what comes to the floor. Now, what you've got to put strategy behind it. So when October 7th happened, I think a fatal mistake here was not funding Israel right then. When they decided to put a pay for, it never went anywhere, right? And 7 months later, they came back and passed funding for Israel. You should have sent it right there to make sure Iran would never attack Israel and the rest of the world knew where we stood. You also then put Ukraine equal to the border. Then you should have gone directly to the president and negotiated the border. And this all could have been done by November. But now all you got was Ukraine and funding for Israel, but you got no border. And all the Democrats wanted were those two things. So you gave up your leverage and your power. You're the majority. You're the Speaker. You determine what comes to the floor. So you can't expect the Senate Republicans in the minority to negotiate the deal you wanted on immigration and say, you go to negotiate, then I'll decide whether I bring it up.
Let me ask you about leverage, because part of the reduced leverage that the Republicans have right now in the House is the majority was already small. It's gotten even smaller. It's down to like microscopic if you can even see it.
That doesn't make a difference if it's 5 or if it's 1.
Well,
it's 217 to 213. It's 4 seats. Listen. When you're tight like that, sometimes you're focused better. Is it tough? Yeah, but it's just as tough here as it was with 2 or 3 more seats because the other 2 seats are being filled in the next month. My seat will be filled on the 21st of this month. So then there's another one.
When critics say you applied for a job for 2 years and you left the position when you lost the speakership, you left Congress, they say that's not a great look. He should stay and finish the term. What's your response to that?
You know, that's a fair criticism. And what I went through and what the decision-making, like – after we went out, a number of people said, you should go win more seats again because you've always won as leader and come back and be speaker again. Okay, so if I was out raising money and recruiting candidates, is that helping the speaker or is that undercutting the speaker?
The new speaker.
The new speaker.
Yeah.
No. And if we win more seats, should I run for speaker or the speaker should be still be speaker? Now, I'm not on any committees. I did everything else. And there's a couple things that are personal that I looked at. I was 58 years old. My father died at age 58. That was weighing on me in all perspective of what I do. I've also done everything within Congress. It was difficult if I went to the conferences and the new speaker, Mike Johnson's there, because if I get up and talk, people, if 96% of them support me and I say something, then is that undercutting? It's kind of like—
And Pelosi's doing it, right, on the other side.
Oh, yeah, because she's undercutting Hakeem every day.
Oh, really?
Oh, why is she staying? Does she not think Hakeem can lead? I mean, it undercuts. If you privately look, Hakeem hates that she's still there. It bothers him to no end that she's still there.
Huh.
Why is she still
you
there?
You hear that from Democrats?
Yeah, I heard it from them all the time. They're frustrated. They're not allowed. Okay, if you're running a company and you put a new CEO in, are you still going to go in and run it? I mean, what I told Mike at the very beginning, I won't come to conference unless you want me to because it harms him. In a way, he's got to be able to and be allowed, not able, but be allowed to be the speaker.
So let me ask you this. We only have about 2 minutes left. You've now been out for a while here, a couple months.
The last thing, too, I tell you, I knew Higgins was leaving the Democrat. So if I left at that time, my seat could be filled this month. So as the Democrat comes in, the Republican comes. So there would be no loss.
Yeah, that's part of the calculation.
Yeah.
Just quickly here. you're now on the outside watching this. You're not as in it. You're not in the front row involved in the room. It gives you a different perspective on some of it now.
It does.
You were marveling during the break, 1 minute left, about how much worse the president has been than you ever expected. From the outside, has that hit you harder?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at inflation, you look at our standing around the world, I still have a lot of world leaders I talk to on a regular basis, and they're just wondering what's happening to America, right? I've worked with this president when he's vice president other times. He's not the same man that he was before. You can't have an attack on Israel and be the world leader and have to put a lid on it that day. You've got to be able to go out and communicate. I've watched what he has done just from a philosophical basis. It's no different than having Bernie Sanders in, but Bernie Sanders is more with it than he is. Mm. And that's the difficulty we have. We're leaderless. Now, will he get reelected? I doubt it. When he won last time, he won by 48,918 votes, and his favorability was plus 10. It's now minus 20.
In certain states, right? In the swing states.
Yeah, but your electoral college is just the swing states right. that matter. And so now, if you look at his polling where it was with Hispanics and Black Americans, he's still carrying them, but not like he was before.
So you think Trump's going to win?
If the election was today, Trump would win. But the election's in November. Anybody... It could all change.
Would you take a role in the Trump administration if he wins?
Look, my point is I support Trump. I want Trump to win. I'm going to help any way I can. I believe being a public servant, you'd help at anybody. If I'm the best person to do something and someone calls, I'd look at it and I would do it. But that's not what I'm looking to do, no.
Okay. Kevin McCarthy, former Speaker of the House, with us in studio here on the Guy Benson Show. We got a lot in there. It's great to see you. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
We're back here on The Guy Benson Show. Glad to have you along. There's a poll that I saw earlier today out of the state of Texas, which I know Democrats perennially want to turn blue if possible. If they could do it, it'd be game over. Now you got Texas and Florida, some other big red states holding the line. So, University of Texas, they've got their own Hamas crowd problems. I saw the police down in Austin said they found, like, guns and other weapons within some of these agitators. But UT put out a poll of the presidential and Senate races in that state right now, in the Lone Star State. And as it stands in this survey, it's Trump 48, Biden 40. And in a wider field, Trump's margin goes up a little bit to 9 points. So that's about in line with what we've seen from Trump in recent election cycles in the state of Texas. On the Senate side, the Senate race, the Democrats are going to spend gobs of money trying to beat Ted Cruz. Right now, though, Cruz is up 13 points in this poll. So they're going to spend money there, but it might be a tall order. Cruz up 46-33 over his left-wing opponent. Another hour of the Guy Benson Show is straight ahead. Don't go anywhere.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a brand new hour here on The Guy Benson Show on this Wednesday. Thanks so much for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. That's our website. Our podcast is always free, every day, on demand, when the show is over. So GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I would like to address some of the filth coming out of the squad when it comes not just to Israel, Gaza, and Hamas. They've been at it for months. But out of these campus protests and the lawlessness, the anti-Semitism, the violence. So Ilhan Omar, member of the House, Democrat, Minnesota, she is very angry with Senator Marsha Blackburn. Blackburn, of course, has been on this show many times, Republican senator from Tennessee. Blackburn tweeted 2 days ago, quote, and just listen to this, do you disagree with any of this? This is the quote from Blackburn. Any student who has promoted terrorism or engaged in terrorist acts on behalf of Hamas should be immediately added to the terrorist watch list and placed on the TSA no-fly list. That is the statement from Marsha Blackburn. If you're a student, you're promoting terrorism, or you're engaged in terrorism, you should be on terrorism watch lists. And I've seen other senators make similar points saying, if you're a foreign national, if you're a guest in this country, it's time for that visa to be revoked and for you to be sent away. I fully support all of that. Now, I will say, I think there's a difference between really objectionable, odious speech and actual promotion or engagement in terrorism. I think we need to be careful about what those lines look like. But if you clearly cross a line into promoting or funding or doing terrorism, I think at the very least you should be placed on some watch lists or fast-tracked out of the country if you aren't a U.S. citizen, if you're here on a student visa. I don't think that should be controversial, but to Ilhan Omar, boy, is it ever. She responded to this. She took a screenshot of Blackburn's tweet, and she wrote, "A sitting senator labels Americans protesting against a foreign country accused of carrying out a genocide funded with our tax dollars as terrorists and puts a target on their back to be attacked. This is insanely dangerous, and somehow no one will condemn it." Okay, well, first of all, that's not even what Blackburn said, as you can see directly in the screenshot. You can actually read the words. Blackburn said, if you're a student who's promoted terrorism or engaged in terrorist acts. And then Ilhan Omar transforms that into saying, well, if you're a protester. The vast majority of these protesters, while I think they're deeply immoral or ignorant, dead wrong, I can keep going on with pejoratives, they have stopped short of terrorism promotion or funding or aiding and abetting or actually carrying out acts of violence or terrorism. Right, so there's a line there. Ilhan Omar obliterates the line and pretends like, oh, Blackburn's just calling for anyone who's protesting to be called and labeled a terrorist and put a target on their back. Oh, it's insanely, insanely dangerous. Okay, so as I said, number one, that is not what Blackburn wrote. Number two, there is no genocide being committed by the Israelis. There is no genocide in Gaza. There are deaths, many of which are Hamas terrorists being killed, in a war that was started by Hamas terrorists. Hamas invaded Israel, murdered and raped and tortured a bunch of innocent Jewish civilians, starting the war that is still raging right now. Hamas started this. They did it with unconscionable evil. Israel has been fighting back, doing everything they can to minimize civilian casualties, as actual experts of war will explain and lay out. In some detail, we read, for example, a piece from maybe the foremost urban warfare expert in the country at West Point, saying that Israel has created a whole new standard when it comes to urban warfare in terms of trying to protect civilians, even though the terrorists are putting civilians in harm's way on purpose as part of their strategy. Now and forever, this is what they've always done. They embed with the civilians, schools, hospitals, mosques. It's evil. And even with all of those really difficult challenges and obstacles placed in front of the Israelis, speed bumps to their righteous war effort in the form of civilians placed there by the terrorists, they are doing what they can to minimize and mitigate civilian casualties to an extraordinary degree. And Ilhan Omar is still out there, along with all of them, using the word genocide. And then it's actually pretty amazing when she, meaning Omar, is saying that by criticizing people with, let's say, inflammatory words, you put them at risk. Oh, target on their back to be attacked, she said. That's what Blackburn did, supposedly, in her tweet. Insanely dangerous, Omar called it. Ilhan Omar just the other day referred to pro-Israel Jews as pro-genocide. Under her own stupid rules that she doesn't even believe and only wants to apply to other people, that would definitely constitute dangerous, insane rhetoric that puts a target on people's back to be attacked. Pro-genocide? Pro-genocide. What an absolutely despicable, horrible smear from Ilhan Omar of these vast majority of American Jews who support the state of Israel. In fact, that's why she is now potentially going to be censured, calling pro-Israel Jews pro-genocide, especially given what happened to the Jewish people within living memory of some people still on this earth. That's a revolting set of comments, as usual, from one Ilhan Omar. Now, she might not have a problem with people who support terrorism. She's an anti-Semite. The record is clear on that. This is also the same woman, I'll remind you, who gave a speech, a few years ago, in which she said this, cut 28.
CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties.
She described 9/11 as some people did something. Some people did something. That was her shorthand for a terrorist attack on U.S. soil, the worst one ever, that murdered nearly 3,000 Americans. Some people did something, is how she described that. And by the way, when I was going back to fact check myself and make sure I remembered that correctly, something I had actually forgotten about the context of the some people did something quote was it came in a speech or remarks that she offered at the Council for American Islamic Relations, a.k.a. CARE. Why does that group sound familiar? Well, it's because CARE, which presents itself as the arbiters of Islamophobia, the enforcers against so-called Islamophobia in this country, walking around on eggshells at all times, hair trigger alert, waiting to find anything they can cast as Islamophobic, the leader of CARE, the executive director of that group, openly celebrated the October 7th Hamas slaughter of 1,200 Jews in Israel. So Ilhan Omar described 9/11 as some people did something as she was defending previous remarks at CARE, whose leader then subsequently celebrated a gruesome and ghastly terrorist attack. Is it Islamophobic to notice that? I'm sure CARE would say that, but CARE would probably say that being against Hamas is Islamophobic. They seem to conflate Hamas with Islam, which is a very disturbing thing that I completely reject. I think actually that conflation is actually Islamophobic, yet it appears to be the position of the leader of CARE, where Ilhan Omar was, of course, a very welcome guest. And ultimately, within that milieu, had to justify something she had said and decided that her quick summary of 9/11 would be some people did something. I will also note about Ilhan Omar, let's say this censure moves forward. Let's say she is censured by the House. She would join the ranks of her fellow anti-Semite, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib from Michigan. And I don't just throw the term anti-Semite around loosely. I think there's a lot of people who are anti-Israel, who are profoundly wrong about it, who maybe don't know nearly enough to spout off the way that they do, or they're willing to countenance anti-Semitism and pro-terrorism slogans because they're caught up in the moment and it's the current thing that their tribe is doing. I think that's sickening. If I were at some big rally for something that I thought I believed in and I saw all this seething hatred around me and bigotry, I would get the hell out of there. Still, I'm not willing to label every single one of those participants an anti-Semite. Some people earn it, though, that term, that moniker. It's a descriptor. And it describes accurately these two members of Congress that I'm talking about so far, Omar and Tlaib. Tlaib, of course, was censured. I believe the trigger for that was knowingly lying repeatedly about Israel bombing a hospital that they didn't do. That was debunked almost immediately, a very dangerous lie that sparked riots around the world. Islamic Jihad misfired one of their rockets, and it landed near a hospital. The terrorists came out and said, Israel bombed the hospital, there's hundreds of children dead. Lying as usual, instantly lying, and a bunch of people picked it up, including Rashida Tlaib. And after even a lot of the shameless, reckless journalists eventually backed away from repeating the lie, even Ilhan Omar at some point had the sense to kind of walk away a little bit, back away slowly. Tlaib kept shrieking at the top of her lungs. So she got censured. I mean, there's any number of things you could probably censure her for. Remember our colleague, Hillary Vaughn, tracking her down through Congress, asking her if she would condemn the beheading of babies by Hamas terrorists, which is confirmed, by the way. There is forensic evidence of that. And she repeatedly refused to condemn it. She was one of two members of Congress, she and Cori Bush, fellow squadster, the only two members to vote against a resolution barring October 7th massacre participants from entering the United States. Rashida Tlaib was a no on that bill. She was the only member of the House who refused to support a bill condemning the rape and sexual violence of Hamas. That's Rashida Tlaib. That's how much she hates the you-know-whos in Israel, the state of the you-know-whos, whom she hates. A flaming, unapologetic bigot. She's been censured, and now maybe Ilhan Omar will join. Having called pro-Israel, pro-Jewish state Jews genocide supporters. Quote, pro-genocide. Absolutely sickening. And she has the gall, she has the audacity to lecture other members of Congress for saying dangerous things. I mean, it's actually quite telling for Ilhan Omar to see a tweet that condemns people who have promoted or engaged in terrorism, saying there should be consequences for those people. And she feels instantly a compulsion to defend terrorism supporters and or practitioners. Isn't that interesting? I think the kids say it's telling on yourself again. It's the old when people tell you who they really are, you should believe them. I mean, it's not ambiguous who Ilhan Omar really is. Two of their additional comrades in the squad are AOC, who is barfing out some nonsense on social media, and Jamal Bowman, who continues to cover himself in disgrace on a regular basis. It's kind of a habit. It's sort of his thing. I will address what AOC and Bowman had to say when we come back from this short break on The Guy Benson Show.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
I'm Guy Benson. We're back here on The Guy Benson Show. I had a few things to say about some members of the squad in the previous segment. I think I mentioned three of them. How about two more? Jamal Bowman, when he's not busy pulling a fire alarm and lying about it during a congressional session, that's that guy, and then calling Republicans Nazis for criticizing him for actually doing something that is literally illegal, he is also an anti-Semite. He is very much someone who has earned that term as well, that label. And he's crazy on the issue of Israel. In fact, he was attacking, of course, the police for going in at the behest of Colombia to clear out the building that had been unlawfully taken over by violent revolutionaries. He was calling it over-policing, and he was outraged. He said these are nonviolent student protesters. No, they're not. They're on camera assaulting Jewish students trying to protect the building, and they smashed in windows and took over the building. There's an image of one of them physically scuffling with one of the janitors in the building who said that they were held against their will for a period of time. One of the janitors, a custodian, said they were held hostage, which would be, again, very on brand for Hamas supporters. Bowman looks at that and calls them peaceful, nonviolent protesters. I guess unless you ignore all of the illegal, violent things that they're doing. He was also quoted talking about these very students, the ones who occupied the building, the violent, vicious, pro-Hamas haters. He said, and I quote, "The protesters are gonna do what they gotta do." That's his easy breezy take on all of this. He's with them. He supports them. He's glad they're doing this. This is a member of Congress. His district includes the burbs in Westchester. He's got a serious challenger in the Democratic primary. So does Cori Bush, by the way, in Missouri. I hope they lose. What an embarrassment to have this man representing you. Can you pull the fire alarm on his career, please, voters of Westchester? The protesters are going to do what they got to do. Then finally, AOC. Very upset to see the police going in, of course. They're anti-law and order. They're defund the police people, right? They hate the police, just to be clear. They've been consistent on this for years. And she's saying if any kid is hurt tonight, responsibility will fall on the mayor and university presidents. She called it a nightmare in the making, saying there should have been a safe de-escalatory path. There's no de-escalation with people who are doing the escalating. And my dear friend Mary Catherine Hamm had a great tweet in response to this saying, yes, the police should behave ethically, but when you cross a line into criminal activity and violence, then sometimes, yes, police need to intervene, including forcibly removing people from places they're not allowed to be and demanding that they act in a pristine way where no one could possibly get hurt while the kids, the mob, are allowed to do anything they want with no rules. It's actually a mirror. It's an allegory to the standards on Israel and Hamas. Hamas can murder and kill and rape and torture all they want, and Israel's response cannot cross a single line or else it will be labeled a genocide. It's actually a very similar, twisted, sick mentality and double standard. Very much on brand for AOC and her merry band of far-left Hamas sympathizers and or supporters. What a disgrace. Take out the trash, voters. I beg of you. The Guy Benson Show continues with Andy McCarthy joining us after this.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
We are halfway through the broadcast week here on The Guy Benson Show. Halfway through the program as well. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com for the free podcast every day on demand, no charge. Back with us now, Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, former federal prosecutor, best-selling author as well, Andrew C. McCarthy on social. Andy, as always, welcome back, sir.
Guy, great to be with you.
All right, I want to talk about this Trump trial, a few developments. We were asking Kerry Urban about it yesterday as well. Just want to get your take on this judgment from the presiding judge in the case, the Biden donor, I'll remind people, who is now holding Donald Trump in contempt because of his violations of this gag order. They don't want Trump talking about the case, although other people are allowed to talk about the case, including Michael Cohen publicly, but not Trump, the man running for president. And so he has been spouting off about it nonetheless, and this has resulted now in a multi-$1,000 fine. The judge said he wishes he could have fined Trump even more, was even indicating about the possibility of jail time if this persists. I just wonder what you make of this wrinkle in the saga.
Well, I've been opposed to the gag order from the beginning. And as a result of that, like my objections to it, which are basically constitutional and have to do with the arrogance of these judges, I don't think Merchan is alone in this. I would put Judge Chutkan in Washington in this category as well. The arrogance of these judges who don't think that anything, including the constitutional importance of, the public interest in elections with uninhibited political speech and Trump's constitutional right to run for president, they don't think they have to give an inch on the administration of justice in these gag orders, notwithstanding that there's no law enforcement reason why these trials have to be taking place before the election. So if they were really that worried about the administration of justice, you just put the case off until after the election, and then you have a much better case that your administration of justice in the trial should take precedence over these other constitutional concerns. So it seems to me
that the whole point is to do it before the election.
Right. So that's my main objection, Guy. As far as the where the rubber meets the road, the way this is coming out, I actually think it's mainly theater. As long as Judge Merchan doesn't put Trump in jail, which I think even he knows would be a catastrophe for Democrats, and I think the judge is very concerned about that, then I think, if he's going to – if I were Trump, I'd be tempted like every Monday to come in and give him a check for $10,000 to cover this week and then go out and say whatever I want to say because that's what I think he's going to do. I don't think I don't think, you know, he's going to go out and say what he's going to say. And I don't think Merchan's going to put him in prison. So if that's all it is, then this is just, you know, one more bit of farce in a completely farcical saga is a good word for it that you used.
On this judge, quickly, I've made the point a few times, and it sparked a curiosity. I just think it's kind of mind-bending that this man donated money to the Joe Biden for president campaign in the last time these two men met up for an election. So in 2020, this guy was a Biden donor. He's donated to other lefty causes. His daughter, I guess, is a fundraiser activist for Democrats and the left. Daughter's maybe a separate issue, but the fact that there's a record of this guy donating against Donald Trump to Trump's opponent, his second time opponent, last time they met in the election, why is that not grounds for a recusal? Like, why can't you just step aside and say, yep, I wanted Trump to lose and I wanted Joe Biden to win and I gave money to that effect and those are my beliefs and therefore maybe I'm not the guy to sit behind the bench during this trial now that there's a rerun of that exact same election happening literally right now during the trial?
Yeah, you're making a good case for what a good judge would do, which is a good judge wouldn't have to be told that he's not the right judge for this case. What Merchan has said instead, waving around an ethics opinion from the division of the New York State courts that handle that stuff, is that the contribution is so de minimis, such a small amount of money, that it shouldn't be counted against him because it's negligible. To my mind, Guy, I think that even makes it worse in some ways, because a contribution of what we're talking about, which was, what, $30, $35, something like that, it's too small to have any actual impact on the election. The only reason you do it is to show that whose team you're on. In New York, it was important for Merchan to at least register that he was with Biden.
Yeah, it's symbolic tribalism.
I'm sorry?
It's symbolic tribalism. Like, look, here's a token amount that I am putting out there of my money just to prove that I am very much on this team and against that guy. And that guy's now the defendant.
That's right. And I would also say, with respect to the daughter, who is a Democratic political operative who works for Democrats who define themselves by their loathing of Trump, I actually think that's not only a very important issue. I think the easy way to turn it around is if you were not the judge on the case, but you were part of the veneer, part of the jury pool, you would obviously be asked about your family members. That happens in every single trial. Would you, as Trump's lawyer, let a juror stay on the jury my daughter works for the guys who are running against the defendant?
Yeah, it's like, oh, my daughter works for Adam Schiff. Can I stay or do I get to be excused? Your call, lawyers. And I guess the same question then applies to the judge. I hadn't even thought of that. If you had someone in the jury pool who stood up and said, oh, I donated money to Joe Biden last time because I really wanted Biden to beat Trump because I can't stand Trump, would that potential juror survive voir dire? Would that person be out?
I would think it would be a basis for a challenge for cause, that you wouldn't even have to waste a peremptory, which are precious if there's a lot of jurors you need to get rid of who, you know, seem like they're leaning the wrong way from your perspective, but you don't
have to. And then this guy's the judge. Like, if you can maybe get that person excused from the jury for that, how is it acceptable for the judge to have done that?
I don't think it is, Guy, and I always think the best way to explain this to people is just ask if it was a juror instead of the judge. Would you keep a juror like that on the jury? Of course not.
I think that's an important point. Now, back to the law. You've written a piece arguing that the prosecution here by Alvin Bragg is unconstitutional under New York State law, under that framework. What is the crux of your argument there?
That there's a provision of the New York State Constitution which forbids the legislature to incorporate other law by reference, which means in a criminal statute or in any statute in New York, but here we're talking about criminal statutes, you're supposed to lay out explicitly what the conduct is that the statute is prohibiting so that people are not in the dark about what's been proscribed. You have to either say, for example, if you falsify your business records in order to conceal a violation of the federal campaign laws, You have to say that in the statute. If you don't want to say the federal campaign laws, you at least have to cite to the federal statutes. But you have to put people on notice of what the crime is, and the statute in this case does not do that. Looking at that statute, you would never know that it was authorizing prosecutors in New York State to enforce federal campaign law. There's no indication of it whatsoever, and that's a violation of New York's Constitution, Section 16 of Article 3.
So that obviously is an argument that has not been accepted by the judge in the case. The prosecutors...
It hasn't been made. It hasn't made from what I can detect.
So implicitly, I guess I would say, it's been rejected by the judge because he's allowed all these charges to move forward. The prosecution has their agenda here, obviously. Is this the type of thing that you've just laid out that would be brought up down the road on appeal?
Only if they preserve it. That's why I'm persnickety about whether they've raised it or not. It's really not implicit. You have to – if this is a constitutional attack on the statute. What Trump's lawyers have done up till now is attack the indictment for failure to give them notice. What I'm saying is they should have made a – right.
Is there still time to do that so they can get it on the record that if Merchan says, no, I don't agree with you, that becomes another basis for appeal? Because it sounds like there are bases for appeal sprouting up all over the place in this case.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I didn't mean to disparage their claims about the indictment, which I agree with. I think the indictment fails as an indictment because it doesn't tell Trump what the crime is. But I think even more basically under the New York Constitution, the statute fails as well.
Yeah, I mean, given everything that we know, I would be stunned if the judge in this case heard that argument and said, oh, wait, you're right. The statute's unconstitutional. We're done here. Trial's over. That's not the point of this, right? The whole point of this is
never
to get two words, convicted felon, tattooed across Donald Trump before the first week of November. That's it. And then whatever happens down the line with appeal, so be it. It's almost irrelevant to a lot of these people because the whole purpose here is politics. Now, at the Supreme Court, so we've talked about the New York case. At the U.S. Supreme Court, jumping over to a different case, we had this immunity argument. You and I talked about it a little bit after it went down, the oral arguments. We had Shannon Bream on the show, a lot of thoughtful, knowledgeable people. In retrospect, because you've been mostly focused on the New York case, looking at summaries of oral arguments, transcripts, etc., what do you think is the likely outcome there and maybe the timeline there? I know that I asked a version of this question to you already, but sometimes in the moment, there's sort of a lot of stuff swirling around. Then you let it all settle. You say, okay, with a little bit of breathing room here, here's my analysis. I just wonder if your view of it has changed at all.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked because I spent a lot of time over the weekend rereading the transcript. Not rereading it. Reading it after hearing the argument. I think the case is going to be sent back to Judge Chutkan, but I am not on the train anymore that if it's sent back to Judge Chutkan with instructions to sort out what's conceivably an official act of the presidency versus what's a private act that he wouldn't have a conceivable immunity claim for. I was on the train that said if the court does that, there's no way the case goes to trial. I now think, having looked at it closely, that John Sauer, who was Trump's lawyer in the Supreme Court, conceded that so much of the acts charged in the indictment were private that there would be enough there if Smith were smart and he's willing to pare away all the stuff that might be amenable to being called official acts of the presidency where there might be immunity. If he went back and he said to Judge Chutkan, you know what, let's just go to trial on the private stuff. I think there's more than enough in there for me to get this guy convicted. I think he might actually get to trial and he might get a conviction in Washington.
But didn't the government say and the special prosecutor's office say, no, they weren't going to do that. They wanted everything. You're saying they might reconsider strategically.
Well, nothing is official until the court rules, right? So everybody's sort of posturing until that happens because they don't want to influence the outcome one way or the other. But I think once the court rules, if the court actually says, we think there might be some immunity, but as an intermediary step, we have to have Judge Chutkan go through this indictment and figure out what's an official act and what's not. At that point, if I'm Smith and my choice is either get to trial on just the private stuff or litigate this into next year, given his political mission, I think what he's going to want to try to do is get to trial.
Andy McCarthy, stand by. When we come back, I want to ask you about the chaos on campuses, especially in New York City, and where the line is between free speech and criminal conduct. You're a former prosecutor. You can wear that hat in this context. As soon as we come back on the Guy Benson Show.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
We continue. It's the Guy Benson Show. Andy McCarthy still with us, Fox News contributor, former federal prosecutor. Andy, something that occurred to me, now we're kind of having two streams of news cycle joined together here, and the common thread, to mix metaphors, is Alvin Bragg, the district attorney in New York City. He has basically invented felonies against Donald Trump, taken lapsed misdemeanors and used this untested theory to make them into felonies. And that's the trial playing out right now in Lower Manhattan. And a lot of people say this is novel. He shouldn't be trying it ever, let alone a former president. It's obviously political, but this is someone who is known for downgrading crimes or making charges go away because he is arguably effectively pro-criminal in a lot of ways. Bragg is. We've now finally seen a lot more arrests on campuses, including at Columbia last night. NYPD coming in and clearing out the building that had been illegally, hostily taken over and occupied by these radical students. And I think a lot of people rightly are saying, finally, this looks like some justice, some order. I wonder, in Alvin Bragg's jurisdiction, is there any way those people get prosecuted, no matter whether or not their crimes are even captured on video, which they are in some cases? It doesn't seem like the type of thing Mr. Bragg would be terribly interested in doing, using his so-called discretion.
Yeah, I think there's two questions about that. Would he do it, and would it make any difference? I wanted to make sure I had this right, so before we got on, I looked at the New York penal law. The biggest charge, Guy, is against the people who broke into Hamilton Hall, which when I was, I think, a freshman and a sophomore at Columbia, that's where I had most of my classes. So obviously I was my attention was riveted to all this the last few days. But the charge that the cops want to bring against them for that is third degree burglary. In New York, that's a Class D felony, and there's a no jail sentence for it. It would just be probation. So, you know, even if Bragg suddenly decided to get muscular and charge what the cops wanted to charge, I don't know how much effect it's going to have on these rabble rousers. I think, you know, if you're going to hit them where they live, you have to expel them. And yep. If you want to get this thing under control throughout the country, these kids have to be made aware that there are going to be academic and professional consequences to this.
Yes, that are real and lasting, that don't just magically go away in a few weeks. Very quickly, Andy, less than a minute. If you can give us a constitutional class on where the line is drawn between free speech and what no longer qualifies as protected free speech, how would you distill that down?
It's basically incitement is the red line. If you are espousing unpopular views, no matter how obnoxious they are, that is protected speech. If you're encouraging people to act lawlessly and there's an imminent possibility that they'll do it under the circumstances, that's actionable. And the state can come in with time, place, and manner restrictions as well. And as long as the campus doesn't discriminate as far as viewpoints are concerned, they can enforce those against everyone.
And, of course, conduct is also different than speech. So if you're engaged in lawless conduct, that is not free speech, which seems like maybe a remedial course for a lot of journalists and administrators at colleges maybe needs to be in the offing based on some of the ignorant, illiterate things we've been seeing in recent days when it comes to that distinction as well. Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Columbia alum, I'm adding, to the bio given the context of this conversation. Andy, as always, we do appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Guy.
Final hour of the Guy Benson Show straight ahead. I have a panel of students in town from my alma mater, Northwestern. to talk about what they have experienced on campus. They were over on Capitol Hill talking to members of Congress. Now they're talking to us right here in studio as soon as we come back.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It is the happy hour here on the Guy Benson Show on this Wednesday in Washington, D.C. Thanks for listening. GuyBensonShow.com. The podcast is free every day on demand as soon as the show is over in just about an hour. GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. This hour is sponsored by our friends at the Finnish Long Drink, which is fantastic, especially as it gets hot. I will be enjoying some long drink all spring and summer. TheLongDrink.com. Always drink responsibly. 21 plus only. TheLongDrink.com. Well, if you were watching on the live stream earlier, you might have noticed a sartorial choice of mine. I'm wearing a purple Northwestern pullover today in studio. And that was a deliberate selection on my part because we're about to talk to some fellow Wildcats, current students that I have here in studio, about some things that they've experienced over the last, really, 6 or 7 months, but particularly the last few weeks on campus. We've covered it here. I've tweeted just a prodigious amount about the issue at Northwestern and elsewhere, frankly. But the reason I'm wearing the Northwestern shirt today is because I want to underscore at the outset of our conversation, this is a school that I like genuinely love and care about. I'm not an angry, cranky, bitter alum who's like, burn the place down. It's not the way it used to be. It's too left wing. That's a certain type of alum. And they might not be totally wrong on certain points, but I bleed purple. I'm a season ticket holder, football and basketball. I care about the place. So when I criticize Northwestern, it's not from a place of let's ruin my alma mater because they deserve it. It's this shouldn't happen. We should be better. We are better. That's the context of the conversation I'm very excited to have with three students sitting right here in studio with me. Susan Radov is a Kellogg student. That's the business school. So pursuing an MBA, really prestigious program in the business school. I was not a Kellogg student, to be clear. And then we have two undergrads as well. Josh Sukoff, who is from New York. He's a Medill sophomore. That's the journalism school. And Nicole Feldman of Florida. She's a journalism and econ double major. It is so good to see you guys all here. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So the reason that you're here and not back in Evanston or in Chicago is because you had some meetings on Capitol Hill today. There have been various hearings in recent weeks that have not gone terribly well for certain administrators at other elite quote-unquote schools. And there's been a committee looking into some of the anti-Semitic incidents that have been happening almost as a matter of course across many of these campuses. Members of that committee wanted to hear from you guys. I've been talking to some of them privately as well about what's been happening at our school, Northwestern. Susan, I'll start with you. What did you share? You could talk about which members you spoke to or leave that off the record, whatever you feel comfortable with. What did you share with elected representatives here in D.C. today? What did you feel like they needed to hear?
Yeah. First, thanks again so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. So I went to UPenn undergrad, and ever since the hearing with MIT, Harvard, and Penn, I told myself, oh, it's okay. It's a Penn problem. It's not going to happen at Northwestern. It can't come out from the East Coast into Evanston. And I've been shocked and quite horrified at what I've seen. Before this, I worked in D.C. and I did defense consulting at the Pentagon. And I was very intimidated and surprised that I felt intimidated by 18 to 22-year-olds that had Hamas pictures on their sweatshirts and on their shirts. People were wearing keffiyehs, which totally fine to do. I might ideologically disagree, but that's okay. But when it's fully wrapped around your face and it looks like trying to mirror a terrorist. It's quite terrifying. Seeing pictures of our president who's Jewish with horns, classic anti-Semitic slur, saying in a call out, "I heart genocide." And then walking out of Hillel during Passover with five other Jewish friends, again, as a 26-year-old who is used to being around, you know, big guys who have military training and getting yelled at and harassed by 18 to 22-year-olds calling us Zionist pigs, saying death to Jews, being called an ugly B-I-T-C-H. I mean, just horrid things that have clearly crossed from free speech to hate speech. And academic institutions have a right to allow all students to be heard, but they also have a right to keep us physically and psychologically safe. And I think that since the encampments went up, I've been robbed a little bit of my human dignity.
I mean, some of those things are extremely difficult to hear. I think from a constitutional perspective, hate speech is protected free speech, but on campuses that have all sorts of rules about speech, that standard has never been applied, to my knowledge, to any other harassment or intimidation of any other group. It just feels like there's a big, giant asterisk when it comes to Jews. And it's maybe not about the Jews, but it's about your tormentors that they are unwilling to confront for whatever reason. I think there's a lot of cowardice in the administration, not just at Northwestern, but elsewhere as well. We'll talk about President Schill and some others in a moment. Josh, you've documented some of this. You do a lot of photography for the school and as a journalist as well. Is there something that stands out in your mind, something that you, maybe when you're trying to fall asleep at night, keeps you up a little bit, that's particularly disturbing that you've experienced?
Yeah. First, thank you for having me here. Something that's particularly disturbing, we don't know who's on the campus. We don't. I hope that most of them are students because they're students, but they're not. They're community members. They're people coming from outside of Chicago, the South Side, all of these different areas to join in on this protest. And I don't feel safe. I don't. With the lack of security.
Physically safe.
There is a lack of security presence during these encampments. They hired an outside contractor at some point to bring in some people wearing vests that basically just said security. But it was an open campus, and it still is an open campus. And when it comes just to my physical well-being, there are people who are able to come into this campus and do whatever they want without getting in trouble. Without getting in trouble, people spray painting "Death to Israel" on donated buildings, and no repercussions.
There was video that I saw of police officers trying to clear the encampment on day one. School said this will not be allowed. They put out a statement, this will not be allowed. Here are the rules. They sent some officers in. They were physically resisted by students, by outsiders, and by faculty, some of them, on camera. I saw a student journalist assaulted by one of them just for being there. Like, they want to occupy land that isn't theirs, while also doing so in privacy or anonymously. I don't understand this mindset, and yet we're seeing it over and over again. Northwestern's a microcosm. It's worse other places. That's not an excuse for Northwestern. What about you, Nicole? What have you experienced?
Yeah, it's been really difficult as an undergrad, especially because a lot of those people who are attending the protests sit next to us in class. It's also Deering Meadows right in the middle of campus, so we all have to walk through it to get to our classes. And I've heard chants like "globalize the intifada," "resistance is justified," "Zionists have got to go," and it's made me feel really uncomfortable. And especially as a woman and, you know, feeling safe on campus, yeah, I've seen like strangers getting out of their cars to join the encampment. And it's been difficult. I've had to, you know, call my dad on my walks home to make sure I get home safe. And yeah, and I think professors are also playing a role in this as well. I've had friends with professors moving classes to Deering Meadow where the encampment was taking place, or sending emails saying that.
And by the way, let me just focus on that for a second.
Yeah.
If you have professors or teaching assistants or what have you literally moving class to the encampment. So if you're a Jewish student who supports Israel, a Zionist, as they like to say, in order to attend class that day, you have to go to a hate rally against your identity and your beliefs. That's like a requirement of attending class that day. And they can say, well, it's optional. But if you want to go to class, you have to do it at the hate rally. I don't know how that's not some sort of civil rights violation. I think that there are lawsuits brewing, is what I've heard. I'm curious, the counterpoint that you'll get is, well, some things at the fringe might be anti-Semitic. I saw one sign hung up on the fencing by Deering. Just had a Star of David with a cross spray painted through it, like an X over the Star of David. I don't know how you frame that as anything other than anti-Semitic, but they would say overall this is really about Zionism and about the state of Israel. It's not really about Jews. Look, we have some Jews here who agree with us. How do you respond to that, Susan? Because that is the playbook that's being used over and over again.
100%. This is my favorite question to answer, so thank you for asking it. You cannot separate anti-Zionism from anti-Semitism, because to me as a Jew, Zionism means that we as Jewish people have the right to exist and to have our own state and to have a homeland. We all grew up with stories of our families fleeing pogroms and persecution, learning about the Holocaust. We need a safe space. I think there is no better time but now, what is happening on campus, to reaffirm that we need a safe space.
And by the way, just to clarify, safe space culture has been ridiculed by a lot of conservatives. It's kind of like, you know, oh, snowflake stuff, get over it. You're talking about a physically safe country for Jews to not be annihilated in.
100%.
This is the actual definition, a meaningful definition of a safe space.
Actual safe space, not safe space as defined by you can't have civil discourse and disagreement with people, which I'm all for. And I'm all for sitting down and working with people across the aisle who have different ideologies and being candid. But this is anti-Semitic. Chanting that I organized a Jewish solidarity stand on Sunday with 300 plus people, Jewish undergrads, grad students, alumni, parents. And I went on social media after, and it was completely peaceful. They said that we were anti-Zionist pigs and that we were confrontational. And
oh, it was Zionist aggression, I think is what they called it. Some librarian lunatic at the school. I looked at some of his ravings elsewhere. I mean, it's remarkable that person is employed at Northwestern. He's not the only one. In fact, let's turn to one of the ringleaders on the faculty. Is this guy Thrasher. He's a Medill professor, a journalism professor, with some ludicrous title about what kind of journalism he teaches. It's like something like he teaches diversity and equity in journalism, something like that. He has been not just at the forefront intellectually, if you can call it that, of this, physically on camera doing some of this resistance of police. He also had some interesting thoughts on truth and journalism that he shared with students recently. We'll discuss that as soon as we come back with my panel of Northwestern students. They've been going through it these last few weeks in particular. That conversation resumes after this break on The Guy Benson Show.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
We're back here on The Guy Benson Show. Thanks so much for listening. In studio with me, three current Northwestern students who were chatting with members of Congress today about the anti-Semitism problem on campus. Susan Radov, Josh Sukoff, and Nicole Feldman. And before the break, I made reference to this Stephen Thrasher, a journalism professor. If you just read through his public comments, his Twitter feed, this guy is unhinged. And at one of the hate rallies recently, he actually said, journalism is not about objectivity. It's about all these other things. And I wonder, budding journalists, Medill students, what you made of that coming from one of your ostensibly esteemed professors at ostensibly the best journalism school in the country.
You know, the first thing that we learned is objectivity. The first thing we learned. And this is the first thing that we learn about when we're reporting. And this is the first thing that Professor Thrasher is trying to get rid of during these protests. The way that he tries to throw it out the window and kind of think without the facts is just really disheartening. And I really, I don't know, I think that for journalism, it's just we need to stick to the facts. We need to stick to knowledge and what we know. And this is the opposite. This is thinking how we feel.
Yeah, and I think it's just interesting. Here's a professor of journalism at this prestigious program that I graduated from, and it sort of makes me wonder how I feel sometimes about the degree, given what's happening. It wasn't like this really quite as bad when I was there, but there was always certain strains of this. And to have him telling, he said, any journalism student or journalist within earshot, we don't care about objectivity. Our job is not objectivity. And I think, number one, that's wrong journalistically. And secondly, I think it's almost about a mindset or a worldview of jettisoning objective truth itself. Because if you can say what Israel's doing is a, quote, genocide to justify any sort of horrible behavior you're going to pursue, that is the annihilation, that is the elimination of objective truth in order to make those kinds of claims upon which so much of this hate actually rests. They're building it on a fundamental lie, on top of a lot of bigotry, let's face it too. Nicole, I wonder how much of this in your mind, in your experience, has been ignorance, people getting caught up in a moment, people chanting from the river to the sea, not really knowing what that means. If they were woken up in the middle of the night from a deep sleep, they would have no idea which river or which sea they're chanting about. It's just kind of the thing to do, right? You have a bunch of leftists and they're in deeply steeped in protest culture, especially since 2020. It's kind of what people of a certain stripe do. And this is the latest example. How much of it is just kind of going along with the pack, which is not a defense, but I feel it's less insidious, less evil than just being a terrorism supporter or an anti-Semite or both. Do you have any sense of what that looks like on campus?
Yeah, I would like to hope that a lot of it is ignorance. I think a lot of students feel like they have to pick a side and that it's the correct thing to do to stand against genocide. Of course, anyone would think that, but without looking at the facts, you know, people come to these opinions because of what they see on social media, what they hear from professors, what they see at the encampment, and you know, it's difficult because a lot of people also don't want to have conversations with us. I would hope a lot of it is ignorance.
Let's talk about the administration, final topic here. They were in negotiations with the pro-Hamas or Hamas-sympathetic, quote-unquote, pro-Palestine encampment leaders, at least some of them, and they struck a deal to get rid of the encampment, at least for now, in exchange for all sorts of concessions and goodies and buildings and scholarships and endowed professorships, and sort of the list goes on. It seems like the school is very proud of itself for de-escalating in a way that resulted in the tents going away and a bunch of promises without fully caving, I guess, on divestment or whatever the other ridiculous, I think, anti-Semitic demands initially were. My concern as a thinking human being who can think rationally and critically is this seems to me to be an incentive for more of this in the future. When you're not happy with something, start pitching the tents and resisting the cops and making demands, and you'll get at least something of what you want. Let's think through together that, I think, disturbing precedent when we come back after this break. It's the Guy Benson Show.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Welcome back. It's the Guy Benson Show. Susan Radoff and Josh Sukoff and Nicole Feldman are students at Northwestern, my alma mater in Evanston, Illinois, in Chicago. And they're here with me because they've spent some time on Capitol Hill today talking about a real problem on campus, anti-Semitism, these hate rallies. The whole environment has been toxic. And the administration, we were mentioning this before the break, they actually negotiated with the leaders of this encampment that existed for a number of days and gave them a bunch of promises and concessions and assurances, lots of goodies. And they believe that this has now put an end to at least that chapter of what's happened on campus in this encampment, I guess, supposed to go away, although there's questions about whether it's actually going to go away completely. And then some news that we just learned earlier, seven members of the Northwestern Advisory Committee on Combating Anti-Semitism and Hate have now resigned in protest from that committee because they said that the school's president, Michael Schill, about whom we will have more to say in a moment. He apparently, according to this group, these resigners, the people who've stepped down, they say that they struck a bargain with these pro-Hamas students representing the encampment without even consulting the board that was stood up by the school to combat anti-Semitism. They weren't even told until the announcement was made, oh, look, peace in our time. We've come up with this solution. And obviously members of the board were very upset by this development, not just the substance of it, but the fact that they were ignored. So now seven of them have stepped down and they're no longer involved. So another leadership failure at Northwestern, unfortunately, but I don't know how else to describe it. An absolute failure and another embarrassment. Now, just on the substance for a second, you can quibble with some of the giveaways that the school agreed to, but I want to get your reaction, Susan, to this idea of the precedent by the administration, which is patting itself on the back for negotiating a peaceful conclusion, at least for the moment, at Northwestern.
Yeah, I think it sets a very dangerous precedent, and that's what we've shared with all the Congress members we've met with today. I grew up in a household that really valued discourse and peaceful protest. This was not a peaceful protest. This was agitation, and I think the deal struck, the policies made without enforcement have set a dangerous precedent for students at other schools to be more combative and to take more aggressive measures in order to get what they want.
Or for students at Northwestern, just to do it again, whether it's this school year or next school year, it just seems inevitable that when you reward behavior, you get more of the behavior. I just don't understand why this seems so difficult for people who are theoretically the smartest folks in the world running a school like Northwestern to step away from this and say, aha, look at what we've done. Congratulations to us. It does seem, Josh, like a lot of the comrades of the Hamas crowd are very angry with their fellow students, and some of these are outside people as well, very angry that they cut the deal at all with the administration. They're being called sellouts in the other direction, which is like kind of fun for Schadenfreude and like pop the popcorn. But I worry that this is, again, setting a predicate for more in the future, exactly more of this stuff.
Well, we're already seeing it. If you've looked, people are planning to sleep on Deering Meadow tonight without tents. They're going to use sleeping bags or what other ways to sleep on grass. Luckily, it's really hot there. Luckily, it's a little humid. But the flags are still there. There's even still some tents. And they've already started to – I'm not too old to the point where I still remember if you give a mouse a cookie.
Mm-hmm.
They gave the mouse the cookie. The administration gave these demonstrators the cookie, and they're asking for more. And it's already started. And we still have another 4 to 6 weeks to deal with. I have to live through protests until the end of my semester or my quarter. And it's unfortunate.
And whatever's going to happen next year,
mm-hmm.
and whether it's Gaza or some other excuse or some new cause that they're all fired up about,
mm-hmm.
this is now a playbook that has proven successful to extract meaningful concessions from the Northwestern administration. President Schill, I think, I have nothing against the guy personally. I met him briefly once. I think he's handled almost all of this very badly from the beginning. I mean, you had people rallying for Hamas right after October 7th, before the dead were counted, before Israel started any response. You saw at Northwestern and elsewhere these pro-Hamas rallies, basically, to celebrate what happened and preemptively be against whatever the Jews might do to defend themselves. That's what we've seen for months. There have been well-documented examples across campus of harassment, intimidation, things that would never fly with any other group ever. And there's been pressure. I mean, the school wouldn't comment on it for a while, like no denunciations, and then they did. Then they got blowback, and it just feels like this listless vessel floating along in Lake Michigan, hoping that it goes away. It's not going to go away. There needs to be leadership, and I feel like the leadership has been severely lacking. I wonder, Nicole, when you talk to other pro-Israel students, you're very involved in that community. Parents are angry. I talk to alums who are horrified Members of the board, I know, are very upset. Do you get a sense that President Schill's job might be in jeopardy, especially if they drag him up to Congress at some point? I can't imagine he'd have very good answers for them.
Yeah, I do. I think we can all agree that the administration has not done enough to protect its Jewish students. I remember the first day when the encampment started, I think it was Thursday, I got an email saying that there's not going to be any tents allowed. And I was like, thank God, this isn't going to happen here. Next thing I know, I was in a midterm and I came out of it and there's a whole encampment set up. I think the police tried to get involved, but they quickly left.
They were overrun and outnumbered, and the school just didn't bother to actually enforce. They drew a red line and then retreated from it.
Yeah, and I think the lack of consequences is what led to the escalation of it. You know, I saw how other schools handled it quickly once they saw it was starting. They, you know, said this is against the rules, there are rules, and, you know, those encampments didn't end up happening. But, yeah, I think the administration plays a huge role in this, and, yeah.
Do you get a sense, Josh, because I've heard from some of your fellow current students, just people like reaching out to me on social media, some of them are actively considering leaving, just transferring. Is that something that you're hearing?
That is definitely something that I've been hearing. I've had friends who are actively thinking, how am I going to live here for the next 2 years if they can't get their act together now? And I mean, many of those friends don't kind of see things improving in the short term, let alone long term, and are actively contemplating, really seriously considering moving to schools that are not facing with this issue, schools that have administration that is really taking a stance and really defending its Jewish students and drawing the line somewhere and not just hiding, not saying that there's no more tents on Deering Meadow when there are still tents on Deering Meadow.
Yeah, that's like spiking the football before a touchdown's been scored. And after an entire game of failure. I mean, that's sort of what we're seeing from some of this response from the administration. I wonder, on the key point, Susan, of accountability, do you have any confidence? This is what I've been trying to get answered from some of my sources. Do you have any confidence, given this document, they came out like, you know, they had some amazing meeting of the minds, and we now have this agreement in principle. Will there be any consequences for any of the students or faculty who are actually on camera engaged in physical assault?
So I would look at past behavior. Talk is cheap. Action matters. They haven't taken action so far. They haven't enforced policies, so why would they do so now? No, I have no confidence.
Do you believe that Congress should hold a hearing before the Education Committee, like we've seen with MIT, Harvard, Penn? More recently, there was another school that didn't go well for, might have been Columbia, actually. It was Columbia before things got worse on that campus, so much worse even than we've seen at Northwestern. Do you believe that President Schill and other key decision makers need to be subpoenaed and brought to the Hill and asked questions about the university's response to this?
I think leaders need to be held accountable. Why would we expect, as a budding business student, as budding journalists, to be held accountable in positions of leadership if the presidents of elite universities are not? And I also think that students, not only around the country but around the world, need to hear how they are handling, or lack thereof, this issue. I've had numerous prospective students from Kellogg reach out from Latin America, from Israel, asking if it is safe to go on campus. And people are actively deciding between Northwestern and other schools. And so,
and this mob was harassing some of those students on campus recently, like going on and targeting Hillel, I believe, on that very same day, which is an extraordinary, I think, betrayal and clear violation of multiple rules, which the school admitted and said they're investigating. There's going to be consequences. Cricket, still waiting on that investigation to be concluded and for any consequences to be handed down, if that's ever going to happen. Josh, do you feel like this is worthy of congressional grilling of someone like President Schill?
100%. Because if the administration cannot hold these students accountable for the activities that have been going on campus lately, someone needs to be held accountable. And this lack of leadership, there's no accountability. There really isn't. No one's getting punished. No one. The rules exist, and the rules are fake. The rules, no one's following them. No one's getting.
Well, some people would have to, right? Not everyone could get away with this.
No.
Right? I think if you guys got together and broke every rule in the book, I can't imagine that you would get away with it. But, of course, you guys wouldn't do a lot of this stuff, hiding your faces, chanting about ethnic cleansing and genocide. That's the other side of this debate, if you want to call it that. Which brings me to my last question, Nicole, for you. I know it's been a struggle for a lot of students just with their friend groups, with their peers. This is what really gets to me as a non-Jewish person, but trying to empathize with you guys. You have now seen with your eyes and heard with your ears things that your classmates, and in some cases friends, have said out loud. And I can imagine it's probably hard to unhear some of that. I wonder if you're going to be able to look at a lot of people the same way for the remainder of your academic career.
Yeah, this is impacting everyone, Jewish or non-Jewish. I've had friendships terminated because I support Israel. And I also want to say on the bright side, there have been like a lot of kind people who have reached out to me, both Jewish and non-Jewish, and have, you know, also been scared about what's going on at campuses. But yeah, it's been difficult, especially being in class and, you know, hearing students talk about it. I think many of us can speak on many experiences we've had walking around campus. But yeah.
Susan, Josh, Nicole, really grateful to you guys for speaking out, for coming to D.C., to going to the Hill, to talking to various representatives, to come on this show. I know at least a few of you are going on another network later on with another Northwestern alum, which is important. Your voices matter a lot. The other side gets a lot of attention, and they're very loud. They are not the majority, not at Northwestern, certainly not in the United States. And so a lot of us have collectively your backs. And I think it's important for you to hear that. And I know there's a lot of people listening right now who agree. So thank you. Really appreciate you coming in. Go Cats.
Go Cats.
Thank you.
The Guy Benson Show continues right after this.
Miss a minute. Miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch on the Guy Benson Show on this Wednesday. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free. Show's ending here in just a few moments, and then it becomes available on demand. No charge, same as every single day. So we spent a pretty tough few segments talking about a very serious topic. We will now move to perhaps a less serious topic, maybe. Although it's probably fairly serious in Christine's mind. Christine, what do you have coming up?
So every year around this time, our yearly reviews on our job performance happens. Mm-hmm. And the big bosses decide to go around and ask other people, you know, like possibly how good I am, obviously. But and I get asked about other people's work. And I politely went up to my boss and I said, could you do me a favor? Could you please not ask Guy Benson to give any sort of review on myself?
Like the host of the show that you produce?
Correct.
Ah. Okay. What did she say?
She laughed.
You get a lot of laugh, I feel like, sometimes when you talk to the bosses.
Yeah, even yesterday. I mean, it's the same thing with the big boss. Every time he sees me, for some reason, like he just... it's this weird smile. I just starts laughing right at my face.
Yeah, just for some reason. So I actually put together a little review of your performance.
Oh.
Yeah. So she didn't ask me, but in case they're listening.
Okay.
I just wrote this down. Producer Christine is an adult female who works on the Guy Benson Show. When not on vacation, she technically produces the show, often booking guests. She sometimes contributes on air. In moments of crisis, she reacts. We have some fun on the show. You could even call it horsing around, but I'm not sure I would pony up for any pay raise. That's what I had written down. Do you want me to adjust that at all before I submit it?
I would like you to take that and possibly just, you know, keep it to yourself. Maybe just, like, put it on file. That's horrible.
Pony up. I had to get that in somehow. Now, I was actually talking to unnamed colleagues of ours who work on the show.
Oh, unnamed.
I won't say
Justin,
who they are.
Dylan, sure.
No, I cannot confirm nor deny, mm-hmm. but they these people work on the show, these individuals work on the show, and they thought maybe the best performance review for you is simply just reviewing your actual performance here on the air and submitting this to the higher-ups. Cut 29.
Jesus drank wine. Cookie drinks Cosmos. We call each other the wine moms.
I'm standing in the middle of the street right now, and I don't want to get hit by a car. Yeah, people are looking at me now. So that's a problem because I can't find the sun. Fox producers just got me out of the street.
But I really didn't know what was going on. There are some mighty good-looking priests out there these days. And then all of a sudden, there is another hot priest following him immediately, and he's a lot younger.
You have Cookie and I, Sore Lane. Come to New Jersey. I'll buy you a drink.
Can somebody help me here? Carousel was an aggressive... Nobody should ever have a pony, by the way. Well, I think Christy said when she was trying to train Cricket and when she was trying to restrain Cricket from especially eating the chickens, Cricket would bite her. And then also, I think Cricket killed a goat.
There are days where I actually wish Christine were here.
Oh, yeah.
Christine, that was mostly from just the last few weeks.
Delete that. You were like, that we
sorry.
Can't. No, that none of this can
it
go to the
aired.
Boss.
It I aired need, on national radio.
I need a raise this year, okay? Like a really decent raise. That's not going to get me it.
Pony up. It's terrifying. Chilling, actually, given the context. All right. Well, good luck, Christine. We're all pulling for you, obviously, at this performance review. There you go, bosses. You have all the evidence you need. Back here tomorrow, Guy Benson Show. Looking forward to that. Same time, same place. We'll talk to you then. Have a great night.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.